Good evening, and welcome to Mountain Talk here on WMMT. On tonight's show, we bring you an updated version of a special program we first brought you this spring, a look back at the so-called War on Poverty and how it played out here in Appalachia. We have stories from people who found themselves in the thick of it, and we hear about how some of the turbulent conditions in the mining industry in the late 1950s and early 60s helped lead to the War on Poverty. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Mountain Talk. For WMMT, I'm Sylvia Ryerson. 2014 marked the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon B. Johnson famously declaring America's war on poverty from a front porch in Martin County, Kentucky. Today, poverty has decreased, but Eastern Kentucky continues to rank last in the nation in terms of health, wealth, and well-being. When the war on poverty is talked about, it's often written off as a failure. But as the SOAR initiative tries once again to tackle the issues our region faces, it's worth looking backwards to that transformative moment to ask, what really happened, and what can we learn from it? On today's Mountain Talk, we'll hear from two veterans of the War on Poverty, who are both on the front lines in Eastern Kentucky. Stay with us.
And this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
That was President Lyndon B. Johnson's 1964 State of the Union. In this landmark address, he called for the creation of a National Service Corps, the predecessor of today's AmeriCorps, to help the, quote, economically handicapped of our own country, as the Peace Corps now helps those abroad. And he launched a special effort in the, quote, chronically distressed areas of Appalachia. Two of the men who signed up were Robert Schaefer, now 84, and Hollis West, 83. Both are now retired and still live in the state, in Berea and Lexington, respectively. They came from different worlds, but their paths crossed in the 1960s when they both moved to the mountains to work with the community action agencies being set up through the War on Poverty. Hollis West grew up in a coal mining family in southern Illinois with a strong history of union organizing. His father was a miner.
But he did not want me in the mines. You know, my dad was illiterate, but he was very smart. You know, he was just a really, and he was took care of his family, you know. And he was very active in the union movement. Well, a lot of my family was. I mean, I just used to love when I was a kid to hear the stories my dad would tell about, you know, what they were doing and everything. And my grandpa was in the mines. Three of my uncles were in the mines. I mean, you know, that was the main industry in southern Illinois. It was agriculture and mining, so.
Heeding his father's wishes for him to stay out of the mines, West joined the Air Force and then went to college on the GI Bill. West was always drawn to people. While in school, he got a job working with the handicapped, and he loved it. After graduation, he found a job working with high school dropouts in Michigan. He then went on to work in job training and community action agencies in West Virginia, Michigan, and upstate New York before landing a position as head of the Community Action Agency in Knox County, Kentucky in 1965. Robert Schaefer came from a different world. Born in western Pennsylvania, after college, Schaefer moved to New Jersey and attended the Princeton Theological Seminary. While in New Jersey, he became very involved in the civil rights movement and working with migrant farm workers, and he helped organize one of the first community action agencies in the country under the newly formed Office of Economic Opportunity. Schaefer was recruited by the Johnson administration.
They said, we have a new program called the Special Technical Assistance Program. Now imagine this. They said, we're going to hire 20 specialists and assign them to one or more of the 100 poorest counties in the United States to live there and work there and to develop community action programs with the people. Well, they just, you know, that interested me just to know that. But then I went home. They said, we need somebody in eastern Kentucky in the Cumberland Valley. So I went home and went to the library and very fortunately found Night Comes to the Cumberlands. I read that and it pressed all of my buttons, and I called them back and I said, I'll take the job if you'll send me to Eastern Kentucky.
And so Schaefer headed to Knox County as well, as a special technical assistant from the Federal Office of Economic Opportunity.
For a long while, they continued their usual way, asked no help, and struggled along to keep them and theirs alive. But finally the time came when they decided that they'd carried the water long enough, that their children had been denied too long. They began to hear about something called community action, people getting together to improve their lives through a chain of concern that reached out from their own valley all the way back to Washington.
That was a clip from Beyond These Hills, a documentary produced for the Community Action Program of the Office of Economic Opportunity to promote the idea to the public. The development of community action agencies was laid out in President Johnson's landmark 1964 Economic Opportunity Act and was a pillar of his approach to the war on poverty. As the act reads, the agencies were defined as a program, quote, which provides services, assistance, and other activities of sufficient scope and size to give promise of progress toward elimination of poverty or a cause or causes of poverty through developing employment opportunities, improving human performance, motivation, and productivity, or bettering the conditions under which people live, learn, and work. End quote. But as West remembers, the most transformative part of the program was the designated structure of these agencies.
And you know, the original legislation for the poverty program, all the community action programs were supposed to have one-third poor people on the board, one-third local officials, and one-third agencies, you know, like, you know. And I believed that stuff. I thought, well, that's really what I want to do.
As Sergeant Shriver, head of the Office of Economic Opportunity, explained this approach in a film promoting the program.
We've always said that the poor should be involved themselves in the administration and in the decision-making process in this effort. We've said that because we believe that poor people want to be treated in a dignified way as an equal, that they don't want to be handed things or told to do things. They want to discuss what ought to be done, and then do them voluntarily, you might say. And that it was essential to develop them as human beings, to give them a significant role, even a powerful role, in the decision-making process. We feel that in a human enterprise like this one, the equal participation of everybody, including the poor, including the beneficiaries of the programs, that that's desirable.
But on the ground, in the counties where programs were deployed, not everyone agreed. Robert Schaefer.
The office OEO had funded an 8-county Cumberland Valley Community Action Agency, which was in the hands of those people used to running everything, the politicians and the school system. And they refused to involve the poor, which was part of the legislation, the maximum feasible participation of the poor in the decision-making process. They refused. And so, amazingly, the federal office took all that money back. Now, this would be millions of dollars. And you can imagine how happy they were to have that occur. And then they sent me in to reorganize the 8 counties into smaller community action agencies to get that money.
And so, Schaefer landed in Knox County with the explicit goal of making sure more poor people were involved. From the beginning, their approach was different. Hollis West.
I went to the people and asked them what they wanted instead of what we wanted for them to do. And what they told me is they wanted roads. And they wanted jobs, and they wanted education, you know. Well, that's what I started to do then.
In each of these counties or multi-county areas that I worked in, I had a meeting with the people, and I asked them in each case, what do you need most? What do you want to see happen? And in every case, they said jobs and income. None of them said we need more welfare, we need more this, more that, jobs and income. And so that's what I began then to devote myself to.
One of the first things they did was establish a roads program. But it was the poor people who decided which roads got fixed, not the county officials.
We were able to get surplus equipment from the government at that time. So I took it upon myself to try to get some of the surplus equipment. So we went into Ohio, and I got a bulldozer and tractors and just everything in the world. Another funny story. When we got by, we had about 10 vehicles on Interstate 75 coming out of Ohio here. No license, no nothing on it. Well, the state police stopped us and what in the hell are you doing out here? And I said, well, we got a poverty program in southeastern Kentucky, and we're going to build roads down there. And he looked himself, scratched his head, and said, hey, I'll just go on. So we took it back, and we started a road program. The thing about it, the people got to choose what roads that was fixed. Not me. I didn't choose them. The people chose them. Okay, and each area had their own group, you know, that run the local thing. So they got to choose. Well, okay, we got the road program started. We had some education things going already, and they had a pretty good health program. They had the mobile health vans and that kind of thing. So that wasn't a real big issue. It was already in place. But then the second thing they wanted was jobs. And I thought, well, that's what we're going to do. We're going to get jobs. So I had experience from Southern Illinois in terms of developing jobs and working with employers and that kind of thing. So we started in a factory there. They donated, and I got a contract with a little outfit over in Tennessee to build furniture frames.
West and people from the community took the old building, tore it down, cleaned all the bricks, and completely rebuilt it into an office space and industrial building where they started the furniture business. Then Schaefer found surplus government sewing machines and began a small business that trained people in manufacturing garments and upholstery, and they added on a craft store. Robert Schaefer.
The federal office hired designers and marketers. They sent a designer down, and the designer looks at what the people are able to do and what they're working at. And then they began to design these products, which were just fantastic. One of the ones, it was a mother pig with little babies, snap wands, you know, and children just really loved these. And so those are the items that were in Bloomingdale's. And then they were in Marshall Fields in Chicago. They were in Neiman Marcus in Dallas. They were in stores in Los Angeles. It amazes me when I look back at it. But if you can imagine, see, this is what it's hard to help people understand today. What possum trot selling in Bloomingdale's meant, but what it meant to the poor people to see that building and see that this belonged to the poor, because the JobStart board of directors in their bylaws were required to have more than 50% of the board representatives of the poor, so chosen by the poor. So poor people owned it, poor people built it, and then he brought into it the Lawson Furniture Company. And that was begun by Hollis in the early days, getting a subcontract from a furniture company in North Carolina to build furniture frames, hardwood frames. So they already had that. then you bring the designer in from Special Impact to design a line of furniture, a beautiful line of you know, sofas and chairs, and then these, again through the marketing help, these were marketed through Sears nationally. So at one point in 72, I think it was 72 or 74, house that Lawson Furniture grossed $2.5 million. Now this is, man, this is Eastern Kentucky. And you see, the thing that stirs me today is I know that those people, the people who met the stringent quality standards that would be part of anybody in Bloomingdale's buying something, what they would have to adhere to in order to satisfy those demands and those standards, that these people are the same people who are living in Kentucky today. They have the same basic intelligence, and that given the training, given the opportunity, and given the openings at this, there's no limit to what could be accomplished today.
Perhaps their capstone achievement was founding JobStart in 1968 with a board that was 50% poor people. JobStart became the Kentucky Highlands Investment Corporation, which continues to this day. By the early 70s, the furniture business was grossing around $2.5 million annually. But it wasn't all a rosy picture. As their success grew, so did tensions between the county poor and the local power structure.
What happened is, as we became more and more productive, they became more and more desirous of regaining control. And Hollis is a good example. They planned to fire him. The night that was to occur, Collis spent the afternoon before on the local radio calling out all of the people he knew, the politicians and leaders who were going to come to fire him. So that when we went into the room that night, it was packed in the courthouse, and somebody told me there were 50 guns in the crowd. And because Hollis had done that, these guys didn't show up. And the people, if you can imagine, the people sensed that they had won. And it was just a tremendous lift for everybody.
The other thing, I hired a guy as one of my top officials that had been a bootlegger and actually spent some time in prison. And in essence, he was my bodyguard. People didn't fool with him. So they probably would have killed me if it hadn't been for him. I mean, they, at one time, they tried to burn the craft store down and things like that. But I mean, it was a real battle.
I have such admiration for Hollis because of his courage. He was really in a very tight spot, and he just never knuckled under. And you see, people respond to strength like that, and it gives them strength.
I think my streak was, I never was too smart, but I had a sense of people, and that's what made me have what success I've had. You know, I've always had a sense of people, and I think that's worth more than maybe the education sometimes. I was lucky because the combination of Bob and me, because Bob worked for the feds, and Bob had the same feelings that I had about people. So he was very instrumental in being able to help us get money and to help with the organizing and everything.
Did Hollis tell you that when I met him, he was gruff and tough and had his dark black hair, his Indian ancestry, and he just had no time at all for me. I was this Eastern, you know, educated guy coming in here, and he says, you know, I don't need anything from you. Something happened. We went into this office, a federal office in Louisville, and this executive was there, and we were talking to him, and he said, did you read about that nigger church getting burned yesterday? And I had just come from New Jersey and was heavily involved in civil rights. And I said, Negro church. And so we did well after that.
And as a team, they went up against some powerful forces and had some fun while doing it.
The governor went after me pretty hard and tried to get me fired. And by this time, I had built enough local support that I was getting good support from the area. But anyway, the climax to the whole thing, you don't like this one? The governor had decided that when they had the Kentucky Derby, that they were going to bring in that he was going to give every Republican governor that attended that a racehorse with state money, okay? So we were, in the meantime, we were meeting and trying to organize and get things where we could. Well, we was at this meeting and somebody said, well, why don't we give the governor a mule? And Bob kind of picked it up, Bob did. And so we decided we'd give the governor a mule. Well, we started negotiating with the governor to meet with us, you know, and he didn't want to meet with us. And he finally did agree that if we wouldn't have hundreds of people there, if we would limit the number of people, that he would meet. So we met out here at the Campbell House. Here we come in a truck with the mule.
Because a mule is a legitimate symbol of the poor in the mountains. And so then it was a matter of putting together the team that was going to present the mule and the whole script for that, and I worked on all of this, and but there I was that day with the Vice President Spiro Agnew in the meeting, and then all these governors, and here I am working for the executive office of the president. So I was holding my breath. But the whole point of the presentation was not to embarrass. I mean, I made sure of that because I could not be identified with something. I would not. But the whole thing was we want to participate in decisions that are going to affect our lives. And it was a positive. And the governor wasn't listening. He was just so full of himself that day. He was up there standing on the truck next to the mule.
And one of the women who spoke for the poor people, I mean, she was a poor person. We didn't do any of the speaking. She'd done the speaking. And she got up and made her speech. Oh, incidentally, at this time, the thing had reached such a crescendo that national news had picked it up. And we had Dan Rathers. We had just all kinds of people because it was election time. Well, we presented him with the mule. Well, he wasn't too happy about that. But anyway, he got up and then made a speech and made a complete ass of himself.
He began these insulting comparisons like the fleas on the animal, and then at the end of his remark, he said, As I look at the rear quarters of this mule as he walks away, I'm reminded of the behavior of the people who came here to present. You see, there were 100 media people there. Dan Rather was there. And when the governor finished, it was silent. And then somebody in the crowd, I'm not sure who, said, Governor, you blew it.
And it really hurt him. I mean, bad. He was, and he did kind of, well, they backed off. They finally backed off and gave us representation on the development board.
Schaefer and West recall many such victories along the way. One moment both remember vividly is the afternoon of August 22, 1970, the dedication day of the Boone Industrial Building in Barbourville, Kentucky, home of the furniture store and crafts shop they built with the community. 2,000 people were in attendance, and as Schaefer recalls, at the time it was the largest gathering of poor people in recent Kentucky history. In front of the huge crowd, Schaefer took the microphone and read the following invocation.
And what I want to tell you is what I say here was true and accurate and real. It's not true today, but it was true in that day that this was said. The long dark night of the Cumberlands is ending. The day spring is at hand. Unemployed men, too long denied the basic right to work with dignity, have begun to pick up bricks and mortar and trowels to build again, and the light of a new day can be seen in their eyes. The night is over when men of limitless greed can tear up the mountains and streams and roads to get wealth, leaving behind men and women unable to feed and clothe their children. Day is coming, and the people now are standing up and quietly saying, enough, that's enough. No more. The night is past when a few men in darkened room can determine the destiny of an entire area. The day is dawning in which men and women of the mountains are determined to participate in the making of the decisions which affect their lives. And people accustomed to power and those unaccustomed to power have begun to work together in new and hopeful ways. The night is gone when poor blacks and poor whites can be set against each other and made to fear and suspect each other. The night is past when the poor of the country and the poor of the cities leave each other alone to fight lonely battles. The night is over in which the statistics of the poor can be used to bring millions of dollars into an area to be spent by those who feel that because a man is poor, he must be dumb or lazy or unable to help himself. The sound of machinery can be heard in the hills, but today it belongs to the poor. The sound of cash registers can be heard, but today they ring for the poor. The sound of moving trucks can be heard in the valleys, but this time they move for the poor. The sun of a new day is beginning to touch the tips of the Cumberland Mountains, spilling over to the foothill and grass and bluegrass beyond, and that is what this meeting today is all about. Surely, this is something you can bless, O God, our Father. Amen. That's it. It just makes me cry.
The election of Richard Nixon in 68 and subsequent Republican administrations led to the eventual disbanding of OEO and an end to the war on poverty. Schaefer.
It bothers me to hear people talk that the war on poverty was a failure, that it was a waste of money. Boy, I talk to those people who were part of this experience that I described. They wouldn't say that. And many of those people today are still, their children were in Head Start. They got employment and training in the program, and they have gone on, some of them to college, some of them, you know, to business. They would not say, boy, that was a failure. People began to see a positive possibility for their lives.
When they say poverty program didn't work, I mean, there is so much that happened in that county there that not only was it the employment, but it was some of the change of in people when they got to begin to make decisions for themselves and knew that they weren't going to, you know, lose it. And even still, I mean, we had a meeting here, couple of months ago where we had some of the people come in and we had a lunch and everything, but like some of the kids that that was in Head Start and their parents had a job. One of the girls, I talk to her all the time. She's in the bank. She's a banker now. Which, if it hadn't been the poverty program, that would have never happened, you know. And it just built a different kind of feeling among poor people that they had a chance to make a change themselves and not have to be dependent on or to be bullied into getting that kind of junk. How can you judge? I mean, it's, those people would not have been where they were. You can't judge people by that. How many jobs they got, you know? Did it change their view about the way that the world works?
One of the things in Night Comes the Cumberlands that I appreciated is at the end he said talks about the economic depression of Eastern Kentucky, but he said more tragic is the depression of spirit, which left people listless, hopeless, and without ambition. Now, do you see that spirit was exactly what came alive in this experience that we had together? And to me, that's what's lacking in the whole SOAR business. It's the same people who are used to determining how things are done, and they've got to have the people who make up the majority of the population of Eastern Kentucky to be there and feel ownership and be active and be in the decision-making. So it's just a shame to see this history repeated.
Same thing. Same thing's happening. They're going in and there's no participation of poor people. You know, now they may get a couple of people that looks poor on the books, and you know, but it's the same crap that's gone on forever, and I'm sad to see that. To me, that's where it stands right now. That's the thing that's bothered me so much. There has to be more than just developing work. There has to be a change in the whole system of the way people are, you know, they've been crapped on so much in their life that they've learned, that's what they've learned to do. So it's a result they go in there and vote for the very people who votes against health, they vote against, you know, everything that's going to help them. And the only way I think it's ever going to be dealt with is when they have an opportunity to see what they can do. And that's what they've done in Knox County.
See, my whole experience is wrapped around that structure that the Economic Opportunity Act provided. But I thought that act was brilliant. And the people who put it together was brilliant. Now, but usually you cannot, you know, go home again. You can't repeat. But what I'm thinking is that the kind of people who put that together, given the present circumstances and given the present an opportunity, could develop a federal approach that would match our present circumstances. But for instance, one of the things that I've written about in the Herald is the opportunities presented to Eastern Kentucky by high-speed internet. This new information highway is unlimited, and if it's high speed, it can take whatever is developed in Eastern Kentucky and take it around the world and sell, you know. So I see that as an element in the future of possibility for the mountains. I don't see the answer in bringing industries in. So I do see a future connected to the internet.
Why don't they take this money that the government's putting into these SOAR programs and set up a poor people's group that's got control of the money
Hollis West, 83, with Robert Schaefer, 84, veterans of the 1960s War on Poverty in Eastern Kentucky. Reporting for WMMT with Mimi Pickering, I'm Sylvia Ryerson.
It will not be a short or easy struggle. No single weapon or strategy will suffice. But we shall not rest until that war is won. The richest nation on earth can afford to win it. We cannot afford to lose it. $1,000 invested in salvaging an unemployable youth today can return $40,000 or more in his lifetime. Poverty is a national problem, requiring improved national organization and support. But this attack, to be effective, must also be organized at the state and the local level and must be supported and directed by state and local efforts. For the war against poverty will not be won here in Washington. It must be won in the field, in every private home, in every public office, from the courthouse to the White House. The program I shall propose will emphasize this cooperative approach. To help that one-fifth of all American families with incomes too small to even meet their basic needs. Our chief weapons in a more pinpointed attack will be better schools and better health and better homes and better training and better job opportunities to help more Americans, especially young Americans, escape from squalor and misery and unemployment roles where other citizens help to carry them.
The late 1950s and early 60s were a turbulent time in the coalfields of eastern Kentucky. Mines mechanized, unemployment soared, and the social contract between coal operators, the mine workers' union, and the community came unglued. In a story first broadcast on WMMT back in 1993, Maxine Kenney looks back to the days of the roving pickets and how those days helped lead, in part, to the war on poverty.
In the early 1960s, coal miners in eastern Kentucky were facing yet another round of mechanization in the mines. Similar crises in the 1940s and 50s had been cushioned by the resistance of a strong United Mine Workers Union. But by the 1960s, the UMW was no longer able to protect miners' wages in the southern coal fields. For the coal miners, this meant not just lower wages, but the loss of their miners' health cards, a benefit they saw as crucial to the survival of their families. Out of this concern, the miners launched a wildcat strike, calling themselves the Roving Pickets. It was during this turmoil in the eastern Kentucky coal fields that President Lyndon Johnson presented his vision for the Great Society. The Federal Office of Economic Opportunity was created, and Perry County became one of the battlegrounds of the War on Poverty. The promise of maximum participation of the poor in federally funded programs excited the imagination of striking coal miners who were assisted and encouraged by community organizers who came in from across the country. One such organizer was Hamish Sinclair, a Scottish-born activist. But it was from their own rank and file that the coal miners found their inspiration, in the person of Berman Gibson, a strike leader with a vision of social justice.
My husband, he worked in the mines, and he worked. He got $2.36 a day when they worked. Sometimes it'd be one day a week, sometimes two. They were just me and my husband, you know, at that time. And it was hard on us. But I don't see how people with big families survived. When that union got started, everybody went drawing more money. It was good for all of us. Yeah, that's right. But then after that, they went to scabbing them mines. Well, he wouldn't have worked in a scab mine if they'd have never worked no more.
It was all union, you know, then, even the truck mines and everything paid union scale. I was getting union scale whenever I went and worked and never 16-year-old in the truck mines, driving ponies. Everything was union at one time. Then you had this UMW card and everything. That meant the world, you know. Yet they just took an ocean to bust it, you know, let it go ununion so they could do what they wanted to and nobody could say nothing about it, you know. They cracked it, buddy. I went to work down here for Joe Osborne, Joe's super, at $1 an hour, delivering groceries.
Mr. Editor, if you choose, send me a copy of the labor news. I've got a son in the infantry, and he'd be mighty glad to see that someone somewhere now and then thinks about the lives of mining men in Perry County.
What was going on at the time was a big new investment that industry all over the country was making on mechanization of the production process. It was almost like all their plans had been made without people in mind. And the people that they had forgotten were showing up in the eastern part of Kentucky. So they experimented in busting the union. They'd take a whole piece of coal that was being mined by maybe 2,000 men in one local that was under the union, and they would begin leasing that piece of coal out to 30 or 40, 100 individuals. And the difference was the men at that time in these little dog holes were lucky if they made $12 a day, where the union scale was $22 a day. And you know, you have to look at the union too on that. They had already written this place off. People were starving. The kids were starving. And it wasn't until their hospital cards were threatened that the union was going to take away the hospital cards that I think this roving picket movement actually started.
And I was proud to be one of them. I was proud to be the lady that was hauling the miners' wives around with me. Had guns thrown on us, machine guns sitting in the edge of the bushes and all like that. We enjoyed it, but we faced a lot of danger, and we did.
We usually started at the union hall, and we'd meet there, and then we'd start a convoy, they called it. And we'd wind up with anywhere from 3,000 people, 3,500 to 1,000. Two or three men go to a mine, and they'd get those rocks shot at and everything else run off. But 500 or 600 people go there, and it was so good and quiet. You get what I mean?
In those days, we had only one newspaper in Hazard, the Hazard Herald. I remember this one really incredible article. It was in 62 or early 63, I think, a big 8-column banner headline that said something like, "Communism comes to Eastern Kentucky." And I thought, wow, how could the perception of news be so different? There were hundreds of people who not only did not have work, but did not even have health coverage that they had worked a lifetime to pay for in through union dues. And this has all been scuttled. And it was spontaneous, and it was based upon frustration and anger that there was nothing else to do if these were your circumstances.
The roving pickets. Well, the head leader was Berman Gibson. And he was financed with the UMW and the Communist Party of America and half of them in the world. Once the Lees got on the hills, there was lots of firing of rifles at the workplace, people that wanted to work. dynamiting of bridges and tipples, and then we had to form the Perry County Committee for Law and Order to try to stop all this stuff. So there were about 50 deputy sheriffs. Of course, my feeling was I got no damn use for any labor union.
People that wanted to work had the right to work, and no one had the right to stop them. That's just a free country. And that's what I told the pickets all the time. I'd follow them wherever they went. I said, now, boys, listen, if this bunch of men wants to come off of the job, that's their business. And now if they want to remain on their job, that's my business to see that they stay there. And you fellas don't interrupt them.
Eight of the roving pickets had gotten arrested for conspiracy to dynamite a railroad bridge. And that was this bridge over here. It was the Daisy Bridge. And none of the lawyers in town would take on the case for the coal miners. The UMWA had always functioned here as the channel for the miners. They were the miners' representatives. And when they closed down their interest in this part of the country, they had no channel out. The miners had no channel out to the rest of the world. So that was my main job at that time. And I had to call back up to New York and see if we could get some lawyers to represent them. Because other than Dan Jack Combs down here in the mountains, there was no lawyer to represent them. After the legal defense, we started talking to people about the conditions that were changing down here and taking that energy that was there with the picket movement. And we began to move towards what's nowadays called community organizing. They wanted some kind of representation, some entity that would represent them. And so they all got behind this thing we called the Appalachian Committee for Full Employment. And it gave them a sense of ownership in their own work and in their own thoughts and their own ideas.
Well, and we all got together up there and says, now, we've got to do something, or these people are going to starve to death, these little kids, they can't go to school. And brother, we just about 50 or 60 of us loaded up on a, chartered us a bus and went to Washington. And we met with the senators, congressmen, representatives, and everything they was up there to help us every bit in the world we went to them. All them fellas, we was right in their office.
Johnson wouldn't meet us, he wouldn't talk to us. We picketed at White House, and after the first day, they come back next morning and said, what do you intend to do? I said, we're going to stay here and picket until he does, I think, he'll meet us. Well, it wasn't an hour after that. We see the guards coming over, and he said, I guess we'll get you four more men, five, maybe make a committee, and come on up. We'll let you meet them. So we went up.
We got right into the White House, and we met George Reedy there. And we told them that what we wanted to do was to build a community movement down here in the mountains that would begin to pay attention to the poverty here and begin to pay attention to building programs for the people. He said, well, we're going to set up a program down there. The slogan of the program is going to be maximum participation of the poor.
When I first read this bill, I was then, as I said, a staff counsel of the Senator Pat McNamara, and I told the senator that if more than a majority of the senators read that bill and understood it, it would never pass. And that was because it was. By definition, the whole war on poverty and the Community Action Program in particular was a criticism of everybody who had ever done anything or purported to do anything about poor people.
The people from the mountains had been invited in to the White House, and they were told, you can't go on demonstrating and picketing, and what you've got to do is go home and become a legitimate, you have to organize a legitimate community action group, and that they would be the direct recipient of federal funds. I think this was very shocking and disturbing to civic leaders and business leaders in Hazard. This whole subject of poverty, which middle-class people didn't even want to think about or acknowledge existed, was suddenly thrust upon us in a way that it just had to be dealt with. Up in the month of March, the Appalachian Committee for Full Employment organized a kind of symposium at the LA's Union Hall. The Union Hall was filled with people, and people were standing all around outside. At least 200, maybe 300 people. Berman spoke for about an hour and a half, and it was one of the most amazing speeches I've ever heard. Berman was articulating the reasons why people needed to organize. He wanted to see every waitress, every service station worker, every employee of any kind in Perry County organized, that the time had come and that people who had been without representation must assert themselves. And he put this together in a spontaneous, almost like a sermon.
I'd like to see every man's have a union. Yes, I would. They'll have a battle right here in the United States. The rich and the poor fight right here in the United States. It'll come to that. I'm not going to be able to see it, but it's going to come to that. They'll rise up. I said it and I'll say it again. It's coming to time, they'll rise up.
We'd sit down there at someone's house in the holler and we'd take out this piece of paper and we'd work with the people about their issues, the ideas of good schools for the kids, money for the men if he went out to work, health care, good roads, and some way of offsetting the overwhelming power the local coal operators had here in the area. So the Appalachian Committee for Full Employment was the first War on Poverty, Maximum Participation of the Poor committee to have an OEO proposal for community action into Washington. There was a set date where you could start sending proposals. And we actually had ours in the desk there, first in the mail. And Mayor Daley hopped over us from Chicago, and he got first dibs on the War on Poverty money. And I don't believe that at that time we got a penny from that proposal. Because I think it was becoming clear that if you actually gave people power to define their own issues and fight for them, that they would go ahead and do it. And here was a program that was built, written, up in the hollows around this country, right there sitting at that big desk in Washington. And I think it freaked them out.
Lyndon Johnson made a trip to Kentucky, but by the middle of 64, the time in which federal money would have gone directly to groups of poor people, that passed really quickly. By the time of Lyndon's trip, the system was in place to distribute poverty funds through the welfare agencies, which of course largely controlled along political party lines. This was seen as a betrayal, that the federal government had betrayed people who had gone to Washington to petition, you know. They felt ripped off and betrayed, which is not to say that the poverty effort didn't include features that people needed at the time. Aid to fathers of dependent children, there was employment was provided, $1.50 an hour, I think.
Here was men, when they were organized, making $22 a day, and the Office of Economic Opportunity presented them with this program. It was run out at the courthouse here in Hazard, administered by the local county officials. It was cheap, you know. It was a cheap program. And basically, it was a program that just gave these men a little bit of money to get by and kept them off the streets and kept them out of the roving pickets.
In the end, I guess I remember the individuals. I would hope that every mountain person, business person or coal operator or coal miner would be able to see the kind of greatness in those people. They lost their union and tried in various ways to have some other form of union, and trusting the federal government, tried to set up their own agency to receive these funds from the Great Society programs, and it never happened. Never happened.
It was rough here for, well, really, it's not steak and gravy right now. We were sold out, not down the line, up the line. It's not the little man's fault.
I'm 26 years a miner's wife. There's nothing harder than a miner's life. There's no better men than mining men. Couldn't find better in all this land. Well, the deal they get is a rotten deal. It's mountain greens and gravy meal in Perry County.
This program was produced by Maxine Kenny with production assistance from Tom Hansel and Rich Kirby. The historic material was drawn from an Apple Shop Headwaters video, Roving Pickets, produced by Ann Lewis Johnson. The voices you heard in the order of their appearance were miner's wife, Hazel Bailey, retired miner, Lee Sexton, community organizer, Hamish Sinclair, miner's wife, Faye Fields, coal miner, the late Hobart Maggard, Hazard newspaper reporter, Gurney Norman, Hazard businessman, Bill Morton, chairman of the Perry County Committee for Law and Order, Perry County Sheriff and non-union mine operator, Charlie Combs, coal miner Jack Davidson, strike leader, the late Berman Gibson, and former Office of Economic Opportunity attorney, Don Baker. The music in this program was Clara Sullivan's Letter, written by Malvina Reynolds and sung by Hazel Dickens. This program was produced with funding from the Kentucky Humanities Council, the Campaign for Human Development, and the Commission on Religion in Appalachia.
And that does it for tonight's Mountain Talk. Thanks so much for listening. To hear this and other episodes of Mountain Talk, check out our website, wmmt.org. For WMMT, I'm Parker Hobson. Have a great night.